You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 132 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 Seattle Seahawks, with a special guest.
Seattle Super Bowl champion.
Oh, so I just said Super Bowl 48?
The Super Bowl 48 Seattle Seahawks.
I've not said this very often. I don't know how it goes.
Only 131 previous times.
Well, no, because the first like 20 or so, they were not the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks yet. And some we've done in Boulevard Park.
Anyway.
Let's take a 5-minute detour to figure out how many you actually said it on.
That is, of course, the voice of the famous Cousin Katie. It has been much too long since you have joined us. His third Pelton brother, the official third Pelton brother, I think, of Pelton Cast fans.
Wow. Wow. Thanks for having me. What an honor.
Welcome. I was thinking, I don't know if my timing is going to be right on this, but I feel like a toast may be in order to an anniversary.
Is it? Of what?
Well, I think my timing is off on this.
Is it the anniversary of the Pelton Cast?
No. Not far off. Anyway.
Yeah, pretty far off. It's the start of the NFL season. I guess when we came back, it was later than then.
First, what are we drinking today?
Well, we are drinking, for a second time on the podcast, the Rainier Jubilee Cans. And that's because after searching high and low, far and near, east and west, every Fred Meyer I have been to.
You are a Fred Meyer admirer.
Yeah, at least two. I finally found at Fred Meyer, of course, the purple cans of Rainier Jubilee, which will pair nicely. I got to find some gold ones now so that we can tailgate with both purple and gold cans before Saturday's final Husky football home game of 2018.
So classy.
Oh, I mean...
Elegant.
Yes. They had 5 different cans this year, right?
Blue, green, silver, gold. That's only in purple.
Purple!
Did I didn't list that.
There we go.
That's the 5.
The thing that I wanted to toast to, you're going to have to tell me if the timing is right on this. It feels right. I think it may have been a year ago this week that you proclaimed that it have been the best week in Seattle sports history.
That does sound reasonable now that you mention it. Although, let's see here. No, I guess it was in December by the time this happened, because the Gonzaga game that I know was part of that was Sunday, December 10th, seeing here.
What I want to say was last week, and the week that we're going to be talking about, putting a bow on.
I don't want to put a bow on that one. Can I return that?
The last week in Seattle sports felt very similar to your best week in Seattle sports ever.
Can I give you the good news?
Yes.
Husky football. Did not lose. Okay. Well, we have a lot of sports to get to, but first, it is an anniversary, and not just an anniversary. It's the same thing happening again because it recurs at the same time annually. And that's the Lil Woody's Burger.
Actually an anniversary, yeah.
But it,
that's
yeah,
the definition of an anniversary.
So confused right now.
That is Lil Woody's Burger of the Month, or Burger of the Week, rather.
You're just off? What is going on?
Don't worry about it. Lil Woody's Burger of the Week.
You're rattled from all those losses last week.
Being the Beecher's Mac and Cheeseburger.
Oh, yes.
That started today. Sadly, none of us has yet partaken in the Mac and Cheeseburger. I might tomorrow. That's my hope for lunch tomorrow.
Myself.
I came up with a little bit of a plan.
Did you?
The three of us are going to go to the Paris Alexa show tomorrow at Chop Suey, which everybody, all the listeners should go to.
Really?
I was thinking maybe beforehand we stop at Lil Woody's and get a mac and cheeseburger on the way.
So a second mac and cheeseburger of the day potentially for me?
Maybe you could just not have it at lunch.
That's going to be tough.
Okay.
Well, because the friend I'm meeting for lunch has never been to Lil Woody's.
What?
It's shocking.
They're from Seattle?
They're from Seattle. I didn't realize this until we had the Pelton Cast burger at Lil Woody's, and I was mentioning this to this friend, and they were like, what's that?
And wait, they didn't go when they had the Pelton Cast burger?
Did not make it when
what a friend.
The Pelton Cast burger was there.
Wow. Well, speaking of the Pelton Cast burger, last year you declared... I think this was in the midst of your worst Seattle sports week ever.
No, it was not. It was there. No.
Last year, you declared that the mac and cheeseburger at Lowity's was the best burger that you had all of calendar year 2017.
Well, we were searching for Seattle's best burger officially. Yeah, no, I 100% stand by that.
Yeah, I agree with that. So delicious.
Both of you agree with this?
Yes.
There's mac. First off, Beecher's mac and cheese. It's the world's best.
Yeah, it says it right there.
Which I think is in the official name of the burger, yeah, isn't it?
I think so. Or at least the mac and cheese, right?
I thought it was just called it's called the world's best mac and cheese burger.
It might be. I have to look this up on there.
It's called that. Wrong again.
It's a long name. It's a long name.
It's
officially
just called the mac and cheese burger.
Are you looking at it?
No.
Well, then how can you declare that?
Because I've seen this 2 years in a row.
It's so difficult. Let's see. It just says Beecher's Cheese, world's best mac and cheese on it. I guess that it is not officially part of that. All right. Anyway, it's the world's best mac and cheese plus Lil Woody's amazing burgers. What more could you want and or need?
In calendar year 2018, Lil Woody's had a burger that you personally designed.
This is way better.
That is accurate. But here's the thing.
What if we would have been like, so, okay, Beecher's mac and cheese.
No, don't think I didn't consider it.
Like, that's what I told you to do.
If they didn't do it annually, we would have done that 100%. It's great. We have advocated to make sure that this is on the menu at the forthcoming Papa Woody's in SeaTac Airport, right next, of course, to the current Beecher's mac and cheese location.
When is that forthcoming again?
I believe January 2019 was the last we heard.
It's pretty close.
It really is. It is
coming.
Closer.
A lot of things are coming. The Dix in Kent coming.
Wow.
Could be, I think, this month. Could be soon.
Wait, that's happening this month?
It's happening very soon.
Oh my gosh.
The Shake Shack obviously is open. Taco's Chuki's fourth location.
Wait, where's that?
Opened.
I drove by that.
That's the one next to Chuck's Hop Shop in the Central District.
Yeah. Oh man. That's the one we were alerted about.
It is. That's open now.
That's open?
That is open as far as I understand it. I have not been there.
We've got a lot of eating to do.
Have we talked about this on the pod? This is the place that originally I was going to go with this friend for lunch. And we'll eventually go because it's going to continue beyond the next week. The second Maono Chicken Scene, which is location in the Rachel's Ginger Beer in Capitol Hill to match the one that they already have that we talked about on Talkin' Taco Time with Cam Hanen, executive chef, but also featuring loaded tater tots with Spam, inspired by Mexi Fried Nachos.
Wow.
Maybe not inspired by, but we're taking credit for it nonetheless.
You should take credit. Oh, yeah.
100%
we're taking credit for a lot of things.
Yeah.
If they have a mac and cheeseburger on the menu at the Papa Woody's at the airport, we're definitely taking credit for that.
No, we 100% deserve credit for that.
We got a solid maybe from Marcus on that one.
We did.
I think we got a solid ask Corey about it.
So anyways, this will be available through next Monday at the four Seattle area Lil Woody's locations.
Whew, all right. I'm curious to try it again. I just don't see how you could top the Pelton Cast Burger. I, for one, am a team player over here.
Put Beecher's on it. I mean, that's how you top it. Yeah, literally.
Yeah, oh, you really walked right into that one, didn't you? I'm objective. And I can acknowledge when we've been beat. First off, I mean, look, Corey, who we had on a special episode of the Pelton Cast, Corey Alfano, the executive chef at Lil Woody's, he designed this too. So, you know, we're still like, we're still there.
Are we taking credit for this also?
No, we're not taking credit for this.
Somehow galaxy brain style, you're saying? Because we've talked to a person who made this burger.
You made the burger. The
burger. We talked to him after he made it.
Yes. I like it. Let's take credit for that also.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going with it.
Oh my God. Loaded tots at Maono.
Yes, in the Rachel's Ginger Beer. In Capitol Hill. And then mac and cheeseburger at Papa Woody's.
Mac and cheeseburger at Papa Woody's.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Full page ad. You're welcome.
Oh my God.
Anything else in burgers? Burgers going once.
I'm excited to try it again.
Yeah.
Do they ever do a Thanksgiving burger? Or is this the Thanksgiving burger?
No, they do the Thanksgiving burger the following week.
The week for Thanksgiving.
The one with
is
turkey and stuffing on it.
Oh my God. This is a big 2 weeks when it comes to Lil Woody's Burgers of the Week.
Yeah.
Wow. Whew. All right.
And that's pretty good. It's not as good as the mac and cheese burger, but very good.
Does it have gravy on it?
I think so. Why wouldn't it? It's a Thanksgiving burger.
All right.
I mean, I suppose we can look up this information. It's all publicly available online, but it's better to just speculate wildly.
Sometimes on a podcast it is.
Did you see the amount of likes that they got on that photo also? Like, this is a big deal.
855, is that? And 86 comments. Did the podcast burger get that many
likes? Let's go back and check that. I think that's publicly available. Can we check?
Publicly available.
It's actually no private.
Oh, okay.
Took that one off.
We made that private. Let's see. That's not the original one, I think, is it?
The one with the Rainier, is that?
This one is the original one. That one had 312
likes. Oh.
Actually respectable.
Thanks, Katie.
That was a pity.
That's all we can strive for. Respectable. Actually respectable. Wait, how much did the fish matcha go?
Oh, that fish matcha was so good. 357.
357.
Yeah.
Look, what did that get? That got a lot of likes.
346.
346 for the that one with the beer pouring out of it.
That was the better of the two photos with the Rainier.
Very few of those likes were for us, and most of the likes were for Rainier beer.
Absolutely. As they should have been. Anyways, a toast with our Rainier beers.
All right.
Cheers.
To us great in the magazine. No, all credit to Corey. All right, should we talk about sports? We got a lot to get to this week. A lot of losses. Possibly some future losses.
And some teams taking L's too, when they didn't lose games.
Very much so. All right, we start with an update on NHL expansion, where NHL Assistant Commissioner Bill Daly talked to Dan Rosen of NHL.com and told him that the expansion vote remains on track for the Board of Governors meetings on December 3rd and 4th. However, says he's heard that the scheduled arena completion is November 2020, and that could potentially prevent the NHL from expanding to Seattle for the 2020-21 season and would instead push that back to 2021-22, something that Commissioner Gary Bettman has floated as a possibility in the past. He said, we'll see how that timetable adjusts over time. One suggestion that got brought up apparently by Dan Rosen in this interview was, what about an alternate location the first year? And Bill Daly said, they've mentioned that possibility, but I don't think that's an ideal way to bring in an expansion franchise by playing in an alternate venue for any period of time, really. We'll see how that plays out. I know they have an interest in starting in 2021, and we'd like to accommodate them any way we can. Subsequently, the NHL Seattle group released a statement to the local media saying, we recognize that our ability to begin play in 2020 is dependent on the arena being finished on time. We are confident that we will have a completed arena in time for the 2020 season, and we will work closely with the NHL to keep them informed of our progress. So,
okay.
I think one possibility is, maybe it's very early November is a timetable for the arena, or late October, that, you could start the year with an extended road trip and push back the opener at home a little bit. Because the NHL season starts so early in October, if it's actually November, that's probably going to get unrealistic by that point.
Where would the alternate venue be?
I don't know. I have not heard anything about it.
Definitely the Showair Center.
I don't think so.
Tacoma Dome?
I mean, the venue, that this cap is so much lower.
I know. That's what
Tacoma Dome would be more comparable in terms of size. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't have a good answer on that. All right, the other organization that is not playing games but making news for very unfortunate reasons at this point, the Seattle Mariners. Dr. Lorena Martin, who was fired after 1 year, is the team's director of high performance, posted accusations of racism and sexism against members of the front office on Twitter and Instagram. She wrote in part, "The things I've witnessed and heard firsthand have left me shocked. How can their GM, Jerry DePoto, manager Scott Service, and director of player development, Andy McKay, speak about their players like this?" Went on to say, calling Latinos lazy, dumb, and stupid, especially the Dominicans, and concluded by saying, "This is how the Seattle Mariners treat people of color, women, and minorities." In a follow-up interview with the News Tribune, Dr. Martin said that DePoto called her, quote, "a cocky Latina" in a meeting, and that in the same meeting, McKay said that Dominican players are, quote, "just plain stupid." Also said that Service told her, and it's separately, that Latino players rarely become catchers or managers because, quote, "they aren't bright enough, they are dumb." The Mariners responded with a statement calling the accusations false and ludicrous. And Martine told The Athletic's Ken Rosenthal that she had emails proving the M's breached her contract, plus members of the organization who are willing to speak up on her behalf. We haven't yet seen or heard from either of those thus far. The MLB released a statement to The Athletic's Ken Rosenthal also on Tuesday saying that the MLB is aware of the allegations made by a former employee of the Mariners regarding the conduct of club employees. Consistent with our policies, we are investigating the allegations.
I have nothing to say. It sounds horrible, but
I mean, hopefully we'll learn more from this investigation. I've got the feeling, particularly, you know, she did say at one point that she had reported these accusations, these statements to the Mariners HR department, which presumably would leave a paper trail. But because of the fact that they weren't in writing, they were verbal comments, unless someone in the room corroborates the statements, most likely it seems like we're probably going to have her word against the organizations and that we're not going to reach a satisfying conclusion here in any way.
Do you think this is going to go away quickly, though?
I don't think so, because people are going to keep asking questions based on it. I mean, you know, it's not quite as sensational, perhaps, as the Twitter accounts linked to Jerry Colangelo's wife last spring in terms of, you know, there were hundreds and thousands of tweets that people could actually go through with those accounts. But I think it's the same kind of thing where it's going to lead to a lot more questions, a lot more digging and reporting, you know, talking to other former members of the organization. She also said that there was racial bias behind the decision that the Mariners, that was later subsequently confirmed, I think, by Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times, that they let go of two Dominican trainers after the season. So, you know, I think we're still in the early stages of untangling this very messy story.
And do we have any info about why she was fired after one season?
Not anything specifically, I don't think. I mean, the organization didn't announce this previously before she went public with these allegations. Even though I think Divish reported that he had confirmed it previously that she had been let go.
They didn't announce that she was let go.
No, it wasn't. Which in contrasted to their very public announcement of her hiring about this time a year ago with the press conference introducing her. So
I don't think this is going away.
No, I don't think so either. And for an organization that has, I mean, I guess there's just not been a lot of good news. This is more not good news.
I think we'll just learn about Seattle to see whether it goes away or not. And that's what I'd say about it.
I would say if you want faith in humanity, I would not suggest reading the comments on any of the tweets about this.
That's the crazy thing. This is my question for you. And you can delete this if you want to, but you probably will. Or maybe not. I don't know. Why are, and the obvious answer is probably sexism, but why are fans so quick to side with management when it comes to sports? Like, why is Le'Veon Bell the villain in Pittsburgh or whatever? And why do people, like, constantly in these comments are rushing to judge Lorena Martin, but not much judgment I see in the comments for the Mariners front office? It's like they're not a good, like, I can understand if the team is historically good or you felt like Jerry DePoto is this great GM or Scott Servais is this great manager and you had to protect them at all costs. But this is the front office that's led the team to a massive payroll and not making the playoffs and has basically announced that they're blowing up the team in the future. So, like, what as a fan compels you to side with management?
Well, I think those are separate and probably very much too difficult questions to explore on the podcast. Why do fans side with management? Is like that's a book, a series of books, maybe. In that case, I think it's probably, you know, the fact that the organization's goals are more aligned with the fans than an individual's players are, because, you know, the more money a player gets, the less money in especially in a salary cap sport, but even in a sport like baseball where you have budgets, even if not salary caps, the less that's left for the rest of the team to be competitive, that sort of thing.
But an organization's goals are profits, which a fan isn't seeing.
Well, I mean, particularly in cap sports, you know, your profit is just dependent. You spend more or less the same amount, whether you're good or bad. Your profit is largely determined by how successful your team is. In this specific case, I mean, undoubtedly, the comments leave no doubt that sexism is a primary factor.
I
don't want to get into it, but the comments leave no doubt about that. But
I went through and blocked a lot of people on Twitter.
I think the other aspect of it is, whether you think that Jerry DePoto is a good GM or Scott Servais is a good manager or not, these are people that you see on a regular basis, that you hear from on a regular basis, that you know as individuals. Whereas, you know, aside from this press conference a year ago, which I don't remember, is a very casual fan of the, well, let's use fan very loosely here, of the Mariners, a casual observer of the Mariners, I don't remember this at all. That would be the only time that you would be aware of who this person is, even. So I think it's unsurprising from that standpoint, but maybe still disheartening to reject these claims out of hand. Anything more to add here? Yeah.
I'm curious to see how this one plays out.
We will obviously continue to follow this story as we learn more. All right, turning to the action on the field in this case, the Seattle Sounders season came to an end last Thursday at home in the Derby against the Portland Timbers. The two-game aggregate series finished 4-4 after the Sounders won 2-1 in regulation to square things at 3-3 and even out the road goal tiebreaker between the two teams after they won lost 2-1 down in Portland last Sunday. Then both teams score a goal in extra time, much to the surprise of some Timbers players. This does not advance them because the road goal tiebreaker no longer applies once you get into extra time, and it produces an improbable emotional shootout between these two rivals that at that point things kind of fell apart for the Sounders. I don't know about you guys. I felt really good about the chances going into the shootout after Portland was like thought that they had won and suddenly discovered they hadn't. It seemed like that was going to be tough to recover from in the shootout, but also shootouts are just completely random. Yeah. So the Sounders missed a couple shots and Portland didn't, other than one save by Stephen Fry. And that was that.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I felt anything going into the shootout. I mean, I probably, if you would have asked me the percentage chances of victory, I probably would have said it was greater than 50%.
Right.
Just because they're at home and whatever. This was a fun game. Like, I mean, honestly, we'll talk about this with the Seahawks later, but it's like the season ends, what it was a very interesting Sounders season, and it ended on one of the most fun soccer matches to watch.
Yeah, I can't think of many more thrilling soccer matches at any level that I can remember watching. Just the swings in this game, starting with an extended scoreless period where the Sounders are desperately searching for the goal they need to have a chance to advance. They finally get it. That lead doesn't last very long. Then another period of seeming hopelessness where the Sounders didn't even have a shot between, I think, the 77th minute and then score the equalizing goal to force extra time 3 minutes into stoppage time with about 3 minutes of stoppage time left. That close to their season coming to an end right there. And then both teams scoring in extra time when usually you see a really defensive style, negative style of soccer because neither team wants to make a mistake. I mean, that was just it was the emotions were like a ping pong match back and forth, I would say.
They definitely missed Chad Marshall, I think, and Christian Roldan in this game. And the Sounders just didn't have, they weren't fully there.
Right. I mean, I think that's one of my takeaways. I was thinking back to throughout this match, John Strong, who was doing the game for FS1, was pointing out the parallels between the Sounders and FC Dallas playoff matchup in, I want to say, 2015. Because I think it was the loss before the Sounders won the MLS Cup.
Yeah.
And at the end of that, there was like a feeling of like, this season is a waste. Like, this team needs to rebuild. They're so old.
They looked very old in that series.
But still, like, the results were the same. Like, they scored the same number of goals as the opponent. I don't have that feeling at all after this. Like, it's obviously tremendously disappointing that the Sounders aren't playing on into the Western Conference Finals. But, like, they left it all out there. There's no shame in this performance. It's just, you know, you weren't quite good enough on the day against a Portland team that's good.
Lost in a random thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I would quite say weren't quite good enough.
All right, fine.
But... looking ahead to this offseason, the team is getting older.
It is. It's going to be, you know, the biggest work of the offseason in terms of roster management was obviously done during the summer transfer period when they were able to add Raul Ruy Diaz and really change the fortunes of the team. And he again came up huge in this last game scoring twice for the Sounders. Among their three goals, had three of their four in this the two games against Portland in the aggregate series. But the Sounders have until November 26th to decide on their 2019 player options. This date gets extended for teams that makes the conference finals. So usually in the past couple of years, this has been like a couple days after the MLS Cup when the Sounders have reached all the way there. This time they'll have a little bit more time to breathe after the end of the season before making those decisions. Then coming up after that, we'll have the expansion draft for new MLS side FC Cincinnati on December 11th. The MLS announced this week that they are considering this part of a single expansion with LAFC, who entered the league this season. So therefore, because the Sounders lost their goalkeeper Tyler Miller to LAFC, is the first pick of this year's expansion draft.
Did he play for LAFC?
Yeah.
Was he good?
Yeah.
Huh. Good for him.
Beat the Sounders a lot. Therefore, the Sounders will not have to worry about this coming expansion draft. So I think the big questions for 2019, you mentioned the age, particularly I think two players, Osvaldo Alonso at age 33. This is the first year in a while, it seems like, where he's not coming off an injury-plagued season, and it's not like there's a bunch of rumors about the team is trying to trade him, but still his long-term future is in question. And then the aforementioned Chad Marshall, who is 34, coming off the surgery for the torn meniscus that kept him out of the second match against Portland. And at their positions, you've got kind of older players as well, with Gustav Svensson at defensive midfield, who's 31. Roman Torres, the third center back now, with Kim Kihi taking his starting job, who is 32. And you're probably going to want to inject some youth into those two positions. Now, one possibility at defensive midfield is a way to maybe solve the other question, which is, what do you do with Jordan Morris now that he's coming back from the torn ACL he suffered at the very start of this campaign?
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Yeah, that's the point. He suffered at the very start of this campaign in the CONCACAF Champions League. He undoubtedly will be ready for the start of the season. There was, you know, possibility that he might have been able to come back and play had the Sounders advanced to the conference finals. In the second half of the season, the Sounders, Brian Schmetzer almost exclusively started lineups with one forward, either Rui Diaz or Will Bruin when Rui Diaz was unavailable. You're going to want to start Jordan Morris, undoubtedly. So that's going to be a bit of a change in terms of formation. And I think one possibility is maybe we see more of Christian Roldan at defensive midfield instead of the more attacking role he largely played this season. So that way you get some more depth in that defensive midfield spot, not as much pressure on Osvaldo Alonso to be in the lineup every match. So the other bit of Sounders news, Tuesday night was the annual business meeting where they announced the results of the second ever GM vote. Because of the fact that only 37.2% of eligible Alliance members cast votes, they fell short of the 40% threshold needed to make this an official vote on the fate of GM Garth Lagerwey. But nonetheless, 87.3% of the people who did vote voted in favor of retaining Lagerwey.
Because fans love management. No.
They do. They do. I mean, we thought this was a big, real question mark early in the season when it came up because the Sounders were struggling and there was so much frustration that they hadn't gone out and added more attacking talent. And then the patience for the Sounders paid off with Raul Rui Diaz, and everyone is very, very pleased now. I mean, Lagerwey, in his time here, the Sounders have gone to an MLS Cup and twice and won one of them. So it's hard to be too critical, I would say.
How do you get to that 40% margin? More people have to show up to the meeting? How do you get vote out for a...
They didn't vote at the actual meeting. The vote was cast over the course of the summer.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So they were encouraging people to vote. I don't know why people didn't vote. I can't answer that particular question. Okay, we head now into the UW portion of today's program and start with men's basketball, which played a pair of games.
That was out for Katie.
That's not quite a sigh. I don't know what that was.
That's her version of a sigh.
Guttural noise.
I don't know. Put that on the bingo card, Ben. An 88-66 loss in their showdown Friday against number 11 Auburn, followed by coming back home, quick turnaround, and holding off San Diego, coming from behind to beat San Diego in the second half, 66-63 to move to 2-1 on the young season. In the game at Auburn, the Huskies struggled with turnovers, turning the ball over 18 times, and defensive rebounding. They gave up 19 offensive rebounds to Auburn. So the Tigers attempted 25 more shots than the Huskies in this game, which is not a good recipe for success. I know analytics. I can vouch for that. The Huskies actually outshot Auburn in this game. It didn't matter, both because of that and also because Auburn got up 31 three-pointers, making 12 of them a 39% clip. Noah Dickerson spent much of the night in foul trouble before fouling out after 17 minutes. Jalen Noel had 6 turnovers. The one bright spot, I would say, particularly in this game, was Naz Carter, who came off the bench for 16 points on 10 shooting possessions. He's had a strong start to the season. And then, as if things weren't bad enough, the Huskies are making their way to the airport to fly home on a charter. And their bus literally catches fire.
God.
It sounds like a terrible joke, but... The thing I considered tweeting was like their pets' heads are falling off. It was like that kind of a night for the Huskies.
What?
The Dumb and Dumber? Nope. Okay. All right. Someone out there listening is going to get that joke.
What is the joke?
Our pets' heads are falling off. That's a common line.
It probably is. It probably is.
So you're saying there's a chance?
The players didn't seem to be too upset. I saw on like Instagram and stuff that they were dancing.
Yep, Mike Hopkins said they made the most of it. They got out a boombox and were listening to music in the 40-degree weather as they waited for a replacement bus. They were apparently very so Hopkins delivered the good that came with this was that after the game on Monday night, the win over San Diego, Hop was asked in his final question of his post-game press conference about the bus fire and delivered the single most entertaining answer I have heard since Reggie Evans talked about not doing drugs when he had to take a urine test during a game, which was amazing, and we can go into that at a later point. But Hop got up at one point to demonstrate getting off the bus. You know, we got very, very animated Hop, and he was pointing out his 911 call where he was trying to talk to the dispatcher, and they're like, where are you? Where were you headed? He's like, I don't know any of this. I'm from Seattle.
So Mike Hopkins had to call 911?
Apparently. I guess the bus driver was dealing with making...
Putting out the fire?
I don't know if he was putting it out, but dealing with something related to the fire. You know, the one thing Hop said that he learned that was really fortunate is they were all concerned that the bus was going to blow up because this was a fire. It started in the inside tire well because it was also related to a flat tire. And they were concerned that the gas tank was in the back of the bus and therefore the whole thing might blow up. Fortunately, it turns out that the gas tank is in the front of the bus. So they were okay in that regard.
Did anybody make the joke about the game was so bad they had to burn the tape?
I did not hear that specifically. Okay. That is a valid one.
I'm impressed by Mike Hopkins as a leader, though. Making the call to 911.
he was yelling to people to get off the bus, apparently. Yeah. That's where your leadership is truly tested, when the bus is on fire.
Those players believe in Mike Hopkins now. He saved their lives. I thought this was a joke when I first saw it.
It did sound like that, yeah.
Just like a cap to the night.
Yeah, it was like, I don't know, some random person was tweeting about it. And I was like, oh, that's funny. Yeah, thanks. Thank you for that. And I was like, oh, the bus actually caught on fire.
No, it's not a joke. Literally happened.
It was such a bad night. You almost would have guessed that you said it would be the best week ever.
Oh, okay. This happened one first time. I didn't even say that. Said it could be the biggest week. Biggest. This is how things become retroactively become. I don't want to use the term fake news here, but
wow. Wow.
But things retroactively.
We're going to remember that you used that term.
Things retroactively become facts when they were not actually factual because of the fact that they keep being repeated unchecked. Do we want to talk about this game specifically, or do we want to talk about the both games combined?
My only question on this game, well, maybe it applies to the other game. I didn't really watch either of these games, but I'm not really sure why I'm on this podcast. But, I tried to force myself to rewatch them today, and it was very painful.
Watching college basketball often is.
Why do we even watch? Is there a stat that shows how quickly Auburn was able to shoot the ball
Oh, you think they were able to shoot unusually quickly?
Yeah, it seemed like they were shooting very quickly, just not really getting into offense. Do you think it took longer?
Well, it's interesting because you asked about this, whether there's a kind of a time of possession stat in college basketball, and KenPom.com does keep this for subscribers, and the Huskies have one of the slowest defensive paces in the country. They rank 315th out of, I believe, 353
teams. That
means
that people take a long time to shoot against them.
Yeah, which is typically the case against zones. They don't have that broken down game by game, however. Mm-hmm. We'd only could be a look at the overall pace, which was pretty average. There were 70 possessions, same as the Western Kentucky game in that one.
It just seemed like when the very few...
I mean,
that I watched, they were just shooting constantly.
Well, the other factor that goes into that is when you have a bunch of offensive rebounds, it slows down your possessions. And Auburn had a lot of offensive rebounds. So that may be part of it as well.
This was almost like a game where if you wanted to complain about the zone, this is the type of game that you would show.
Yeah.
Like Auburn got a bunch of open threes because I don't know if it's because of the zone or whatever, but they took a lot more threes than teams normally take against the Huskies.
Yes.
And then even when they missed them, still got offensive rebounds after that.
Yeah, it was all the weaknesses of the zone on display.
Everything bad about the zone happened within this game, and that's why I think it probably looked... I'm going to say it was probably a little bit random.
But here's the thing.
What happened?
The Huskies were terrible on offense, too. Ugh. And their turnovers were a big part of why Auburn was able to get out in transition.
They couldn't even hold the ball.
Yeah, the pressure from Auburn really seemed to catch them off guard. I didn't know that Auburn played that way, but, you know.
Could it be that Auburn is allowed to do different things in terms of defensive pressure than we're allowed to do in the Pac-12? And therefore, it's not something we were used to or expecting?
That's possible. Yeah. I mean, first off, Auburn is a really good team. I mean, they're legitimately very good team. So, you know, you would have still liked to see the Huskies be competitive with them, especially if you believed that the Huskies were going to get into the top 10 at some point this season.
I take it all back. I was thinking about that while watching the San Diego game, especially when they were trailing deep into the game. I was like, this maybe not a top 10 team.
Down 9 at one point in the second half.
But Auburn was, they were allowed to defend much more tightly than the Huskies. When the Huskies played a defense like this 2 years ago under Lorenzo Romar, they would have been called for a foul on every single possession. And these refs let Auburn play so much more physical.
And they also let San Diego know.
Come to Seattle and play like that.
So against
they are next year, right?
Oh yes, Auburn is coming to Seattle next year.
No veteran players on the team.
Yikes! No Matisse Thybulle.
Yeah. It's going to be a lot of Brian Penn Johnson.
Oh, that's
it's going to be a lot of Naz Carter and Hamir Wright. We'll get to that in a second. Huskies trailed San Diego by as many as 9 in the second half before taking the lead with a 19-2 run midway through the half. Then trailed again, but it was kind of very similar to a lot of last year's non-conference games where Jalen Noel just made some plays down the stretch, hit 2 free throws. San Diego had a final possession with a chance to tie it with a 3. Huskies defended very well on that one. San Diego only got up a desperation attempt a little bit before the buzzer that never had much real threat of getting there. The zone, again, you know, some issues with the zone. San Diego shot 51% on 2s and 38% on 3s, but this time UW was able to force turnovers on 28% of the Toreros' possessions.
Matisse was everywhere in this game.
5 steals by Matisse Thybulle, and Noel carried the offense with 18 points on 13 shooting possessions. So I think as far as overall takeaways from the first 3 games of the season, what we've seen so far, heading into a little bit of a break here before the Huskies head to Vancouver for next week's Vancouver showcase, the sophomore class, I think, has been incredibly impressive. Obviously, Noel, you knew about based on his freshman season, but Naz Carter and Hamir Wright, who came on later in their freshman years, are now becoming really important cogs. Carter, you know, the Popkins talked after the game about them counting on him for that bench scoring punch. And Wright has ended up playing a lot more at center than junior starter Sam Timmons, who played just 4 minutes against San Diego, during which the Huskies were -7 and 15 minutes combined in the last 2 games.
Sam Timmons is bad.
I mean,
Hamir Wright should be starting.
It does seem like Hamir Wright should probably be starting. Like, he brings you more in terms of he's going to space the floor a little bit. He can handle the ball. He had a nice drive from the perimeter to the basket at one point.
Knocked down a 3.
Yeah. He's blocking shots. Like, there are times you see that, like, he's not as tall or long as Sam Timmons. Like, San Diego was able to shoot over the top of him a little bit, and they have pretty good size. Big Squirrel had an impressive performance for them.
Which one was Big Squirrel?
The center.
The white guy?
Yeah, he's European.
What's his last name?
Masolsky.
Masolsky?
Yeah. Yoan Masolsky.
Is that the dude that they kept talking about who's, like, their star? Is he an NBA prospect?
Isaiah Pinheiro?
Yeah.
No. I mean, he's a fifth-year senior, so not really much upside at the end. But this is a really experienced San Diego team. It wasn't surprising they played well. Start four seniors alongside the Squirrel. But, you know, you still...
the Squirrel.
Just any time I can work in a reference to him being nicknamed the Squirrel. You got to do that.
A team that they were talking about, they're in the West Coast Conference, right?
So I have a friend who follows San Diego basketball because of their coaching staff. And she was talking up Masolsky all throughout last year. Very exciting to actually see him play in person.
Did he do much of anything, though?
Yeah, he had a couple blocks.
I didn't really see too much of him.
He split two free throws that would have tied the game in the final minute.
Yeah, he was the one who had some ugly misses at free throw also.
He's not a free throw shooter. That's not his thing. Squirrels don't do that. No.
Squirrels block shots?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. If you say so.
Squirrels don't do that. Amir Wright, though.
Yeah.
Looks great.
Yeah.
But the offense in general, just like...
There's not much ball movement.
There's nothing going on. There's literally no offense.
I mean, they're...
I thought Lorenzo Romar came back for a second.
Oh, the look Kevin is giving right now.
I mean, I was wondering after
looks
the
like
Auburn.
Like your mother in that look.
I was wondering after. Wow. Oh, no. I was wondering after the last two games, like, what would people say if this was a Lorenzo Romar team? What kind of takes would they have? I think they would be very different than they are right now. Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that will help is Noah Dickerson getting in better shape. He missed some time during the preseason, including the Nevada exhibition with a knee sprain. And
the Squirrel kind of shut down Noah.
Length so often gives him trouble. You know, that is a lot of size against him defensively. But also you saw that he was kind of going in and out. They were kind of doing almost offense-defense subs with him in Hamir Wright down the stretch. Or midway through the second half, because of the fact that he just doesn't have the stamina to play, you know, extended stretches at this point, and that will definitely help the offense. I think him establishing, you know, being the kind of post presence that he was last season.
David, I feel like this is all on David Crisp.
The Huskies are not getting a lot of playmaking out of David Crisp at point guard.
No ball movement.
Yeah,
there's no ball movement. No court vision. He can't shoot. Like. He can hit free throws also, which drives me crazy.
A little bit. But there will be a game later in the season when he gets hot, and we'll be like, oh, yeah.
That'll all be worth it.
Yeah.
That was the really frustrating thing about the Auburn game, though, is missing so many first ends of ones and ones.
Yeah, that happened last night, too.
I was about to start complaining about free throws, and then they showed the stat, and they were like 15 to 18
15
or something.
And
I was like,
okay. So we're not that bad.
No. I mean, we were discussing this during the Auburn game, Crisp, and I was making the case that he had improved over the course of his 4 years. And then I looked at the numbers again and like, yeah, no, actually, when you look it up, not so much.
Not in anything?
I mean, his sophomore year was probably his best year offensively. So,
it's
only shot 29% on threes last year.
It's hard to run an offense without a point guard, though.
It is. Yeah. This is all true. I'd like to see Matisse Thybulle do more playmaking. We saw that from him, I think, in the Nevada game. One of the exhibitions, he had a bunch of assists. It's something he potentially can do.
Great.
But the Huskies will be tested again in the Vancouver showcase. Not so much in the opening game. That'll be against Santa Clara, where former ASU coach Herb Sendek is in his third year and really struggling still to establish the program. They went 11-20 last season and lost their season opener at home to Prairie View A&M, dropping nearly 40 spots in the KenPom rankings to 233 in the process. The player to watch for Santa Clara, Seattle native Josh Martin, a one-time target of the Huskies. You'll recall if you paid attention to recruiting back then, he played at Seattle Prep and then transferred to Bothell, where he played against Zach LaVine, whatever happened to that guy. He is now on his third NCAA team, joining after Minnesota and Cal Poly, joining Santa Clara as a grad transfer, and had 11 points, 13 boards, and 3 blocks in his debut. Nonetheless, a game the Huskies should win easily as they prepare for the more difficult two matchups. Texas A&M could be a little bit vulnerable. They lost at home last Friday to UC Irvine 74-73 after winning their opener against lowly Savannah State. They played that game without returning starter Admon Gilder and JC transfer Wendell Mitchell, both of whom are battling knee injuries. Gilder also a hamstring. So we'll see, you know, by next Tuesday when this game is played whether he's back in the lineup. Texas A&M went 22-13 last year and reached the Sweet 16 by upsetting North Carolina before losing there. But they lost first-round pick Robert Williams and then two underclassmen declared for the NBA draft and went undrafted, center Tyler Davis and wing DJ Hogg, both of whom, I believe Tyler Davis is on a two-way with the Thunder and Hogg is playing in the G League. All of that left sophomore guard TJ Starks in a go-to role in which he's struggled so far. He's posted a 31% effective field goal percentage on 17 shots per game. And Texas A&M, a really tough early schedule. They travel to visit Gonzaga on Thursday en route to Vancouver. So that probably will not go well for them. The Huskies will wrap up in Vancouver against Minnesota, which has started 2-0 with a blowout win over Nebraska Omaha and then a 78-69 home win over Pac-12 Utah. They won 24 games in 2016-17 under Richard Pitino, but slumped to 4-14 in Big Ten play a year ago, partially because of injuries. Amir Coffey was someone who missed 14 games due to a shoulder injury, but he's averaged 16 points and 5 assists in the first two games. Forward Jordan Murphy comes back. He averaged a double-double, 17 points and 11 boards per game last season. And then 6'10" freshman Daniel Oturu has been a nice pickup for them. He's an outstanding shot blocker. This is a team that you kind of look at them, at least on the Ken Palm page, and they seem really well put together. They've got this talented size, and then in the perimeter, they've got quality shooters, guys who can really space the floor for these big men. They are 10th in the country so far in effective field goal percentage, but they do tend to lose the turnover battle. So that's where I think the Huskies are really going to have to take advantage against Minnesota.
I think they're going to have to score points.
I also recommend
there's some that. Analysis. They need to win two of three of these games.
I would agree with that.
They have to beat a team in a major conference.
Yes. Just, I mean, they'll have other chances, but these are probably their best chances.
Who else do they play?
Well, they also play Virginia Tech in a game that is being played, want to say, in Atlantic City.
He's skeptical about this game.
Oh, you're just giving up on that now. No. That one is being played, in Atlantic City.
Are they good?
And then... Yeah.
Okay.
Virginia, you may recall Virginia Tech making about 50 threes against the Huskies last year when they played.
Just mark that as the L.
That one was that in the Garden? Where did they play last year? I don't remember.
I think that was, yeah.
Yeah, it was in the Garden. And then obviously Gonzaga is not technically a major conference opponent, but that is an opportunity. Also, they're probably not going to be Gonzaga.
What are the chances we win against all three?
What are the chances they sweep this?
Yeah.
Well, chances according to Ken Palm... let's see, about 1-4 chance of sweeping it, which would effectively
not that bad.
Yeah, I think that would effectively make them the champions of this tournament. It's not technically a tournament format.
So you're saying there's a chance?
The quote is actually, so you're telling me there's a chance.
Okay,
I'm pretty
God.
Sure.
Well, actually.
You're the one who was actually disappointed about it. So it's sort of
you
set
go
up,
deep with your Dumb and Dumber quotes.
I do.
I'm just another shrimp that's a on the bobby. Even seen like that's.
I mean, I saw it as a kid. I haven't seen it in many years. I just know the quotes from it.
Of course,
it's a very common thing. Okay, it's set up well that, you know, if the Huskies could beat Texas A&M in addition to Santa Clara, then the UW Minnesota game sort of becomes the championship of this. I think that's going to be the marquee matchup here.
Win would be huge, though.
Yeah.
Against Minnesota. And like I said, they just need to beat a team in a major conference just for the look of it.
Yep.
They need to show that they're able to do it in non-conference.
All right, UW women's basketball started the season 2-0 at home with an 83-74 win on Thursday against Cal State Fullerton and a blowout 81-59 win Sunday against the Northern Arizona Lumberjacks. Amber Melgoza threatened a triple-double in that one with 20 points, 10 rebounds, and a career-high 8 assists. That was her first career double-double, I should say, for the Huskies' leading scorer last season and one of the leading scorers in the Pac-12. An encouraging sign, I think, that the Huskies have had a freshman score double figures off the bench in each of their first two games. Haley Van Dyke did it against Fullerton, and then T.T. Watkins against Northern Arizona. The Huskies will this Sunday be at Tulane in their first road matchup. Tulane won their opener against Texas Southern 62-56. So, you know, it seems like it's a potentially beatable team on the road, although, you know, road wins were hard to come by for the Huskies last season. We wrap up the UW section with football coming off a bye and heading this Saturday into the return of Jonathan Smith as they host Oregon State.
I read that and I got a little excited for a second. I was like, Jonathan, maybe there's Smith news that I don't know about.
Oh, no. Wow. I was going to ask that. That was one of my Huskies topics. Like, do we feel different about Jonathan Smith now?
We've seen Bush Hamden
for
Jonathan
10 games.
Smith.
I guess, yeah, the question is, the rest of the world feel differently about Jonathan Smith?
I'm just going to throw this out there. People aren't thinking too hard about it.
That's fair. Kudos to Jonathan Smith. He's actually got Oregon State playing decently offensively. They've improved pretty dramatically, but we'll talk about that in a second. We do know after last weekend, after Wazoo's win and Oregon's loss, that the Pac-12 North champion will come from the state of Washington. And assuming the Huskies do take care of business against the Beavers on Saturday, the Apple Cup will become a winner-takes-all showdown for the Pac-12
Katie,
North and a spot in the championship game.
Are you and Ben going to grow a pair and go to the Apple Cup on Friday?
You should explain that my husband, Ben, went to WSU.
Is a Cougar.
He's a Cougar.
You're a split family.
And like, it has changed from me being the person who watches football and being very excited to him being the person who watches football and being very excited.
This is troubling.
Yeah, I don't like anything about that.
Well, I mean, look what's happening with the two teams.
That's Mike, why it's troubling.
Mike Leach is
still a pretty good
putting
team.
Putting on mustaches.
Let's just be cool here for a second.
But they haven't played as well as Wazoo, and they definitely have not had as fun a season as Wazoo on any level.
Like, just watching, I just get wistful.
First off, nobody on the team has a notable mustache.
Yeah, like, did you see Mike Leach with the mustache?
They're humanizing Mike Leach.
His response to having the mustache was quite strange. What was that interview? Were you watching that?
I just saw a replay. I don't think I saw it live.
It was a weird response. It was a typical Mike Leach response.
He looked like a deer in the headlights a little bit. And it just was odd, but that's just how he is.
He was not prepared to have a mustache in that moment.
No, not prepared at all.
Anyway,
okay, well,
you're going to be on the eastern half of the state for Thanksgiving.
Yes.
You're going to be in Tri-Cities at the wrong taco time.
We don't go there. We go to Chipotle Express.
What?
Thank you.
We didn't need to specifically shout them out. You can just tweet us if you want food recommendations for Tri-Cities. We've been known to share those on Twitter.
That's the eastern half taco time is Chipotle Express?
That's just like a local
place. That's just our like place that we like to go.
Okay. It sounds a little bit like Chipotle if you say it fast.
It did when you started it. Sorry, I thought you were going to say Chipotle. Even though I have been there. You might have been there. You just might not remember it.
Are you going to grow a pair and go to the Apple
it's
Cup?
It's not me. I want to go every year, but Ben doesn't want to go because he's scared.
I guess you're going to have to confront him about it. We have to bring him on the pod next week to confront him.
Ask him.
He won't come.
he definitely won't.
Hard pass.
And he also will not go to the Apple Cup.
He's
like, what's the upside for him?
Celebrating going to the Pac-12 championship and probably the Rose Bowl for the first time maybe ever for Wazoo. Second time ever.
The Rose Bowl?
They've been to one Rose Bowl ever.
How cold is it going
to
be?
They've been to, I think, at least two ever, but one in recent memory.
It's going to be very cold. Usually in one of these Apple Cup games, something weird happens. I don't know if that's statistically true, but I'm going to say it.
If that's something weird, is Coach P winning every one of them.
Oh, wow.
There we go.
I'm just saying.
That would be a weird thing this year to be happening.
It would not be a weird thing when a better team beats a worse team, but okay.
I mean, okay.
All right, we can get into this next week.
We have Katie here right now.
That particular, who's better, we could get into next week.
Fine.
Anyway, you should be at this game.
I would like to go. I think it would be quite an experience. I'd probably get yelled at a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be exciting. But for him, it's just cold and, you know.
Is a typical Coug fan. He's scared.
Scared. Yeah, he's scared.
I have some comments here. But again, I'm going to save those until
what,
next week.
What, you're not going to make your comments?
They also played in the Rose Bowl in 2002.
Say your comments.
Well, I was going to quote Don James on being a Cougar prepares you well for your life. You learn not to expect too much. They have been to four all-time Rose Bowls, two in 1915 and 1930. They went 67 years between them. It's been a long time for the Huskies at this point, longer than the Cougars at this
anyway,
point.
Anyway, so we know that the Pac-12 North champion will come from the state of Washington.
We do.
assuming everything goes well for either team this weekend.
It doesn't matter what the Cougs do.
Well, not that, but
you're just saying like the hype of this game and
going to be a huge game.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you're talking about what could be the Huskies if they were to win, get up to number 12 or so.
I'd be surprised they got up that high. But they did climb a bunch of spots last week on bye.
There we
up
go.
To 17 AP.
17 coaches.
And somehow they jumped 7 spots in the college football playoff poll, which probably means the college football playoff poll like realized how low the Huskies had. They had them last week at number 25.
It likely will be a matchup between two top 15 teams.
Okay.
With what could very likely be the Rose Bowl on the line.
Or potentially even a bigger for Wazoo. I mean, they still have an outside chance of getting in the playoff if they went out.
I think there's a small chance. Well, going to the Rose Bowl would be count as like a New Year's Six game.
So yes.
I guess there's really no place where the Huskies could get an at-large bid.
No, that's not realistic.
Because they're either winning out or they're not getting an at-large bid.
Yes.
But if they do win out, they're in basically the spot that Wazoo's in. They're like number 8 in the country.
Something like that, probably.
So it's a pretty good place to be in.
It's not as bad as it could be, considering the Huskies have 3 losses. I'd put it that way. All right.
I'm fired up for this Rose Bowl.
I'm fired up to play the game this weekend.
You're fired up for Oregon State. Yeah. There we go. Yeah.
One game at a time.
Let's win that first. All right. Please, God.
It may or may not be a trap game for the team. It is definitely a trap game for Tristan, who is not going to show up on Saturday to tailgate. He's going to be watching the Apple Cup somehow.
The spread, I would say that the line makes me a little nervous.
It is Huskies minus 32, but we're going to get there in a second. We got a couple more topics to get through. Okay. Injury updates. Trey Adams, now week to week, according to Coach Pete. Shane Bowman.
That means he's not playing this week, though.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Shane Bowman, quote, getting close, and Jordan Miller expected to play after missing several weeks at cornerback. So that's all exciting. And the last bit of Husky news, they spent their bye week hosting Kennedy Catholic sophomore quarterback Sam Hewitt.
There we go.
And offering him a scholarship. Sam Heward, of course, is the son of former Husky quarterback and current color analyst Damon Heward, the nephew of also Husky quarterback and current ESPN color analyst and ESPN 710 host Brock Heward. He is a lefty like Brock. Which is weird because there's like no more lefty quarterbacks anymore.
I can't even think of the last time I've seen a left-handed quarterback.
Wisconsin's quarterback, Hornibrook.
Oh, Hornibrook's Alex Hornibrook is left-handed.
Yeah.
He's pretty bad also. There are no left-handed quarterbacks in the NFL, right?
Don't think so. It's very strange. He has put up huge numbers his first 2 years, has a bunch of scholarship offers, several in the Pac-12. It was probably only a matter of time, but the Huskies do tend to be pretty deliberate on this sort of thing, and also he is still a sophomore.
It's a freaking sophomore.
There was a nice question, Coach Pete was talking about basically the philosophy of offering players and that sort of thing in his press conference. And the question was, so the previous coaching staff here offered a scholarship to a 12-year-old quarterback. And I should have it pulled up so I can quote it verbatim, but it was like, you know, everyone has their own philosophy on recruiting. It was like very diplomatic.
What
shade.
Happened to that kid?
Yeah, who was the 12-year-old quarterback?
Something? Tate Martell.
Tate Martell, where is he?
You know, I look this up the other day? I was just reading Bruce Feldman's book about quarterback development, which was actually quite interesting. And he got mentioned in that because, he's at Ohio State as the backup now. Yeah, that's... So
What is his... He's a junior, senior?
He's 20 years old, but I think he's still a freshman in terms of eligibility.
Freshman. Okay, so he still could be like the promised...
You got to talk into the microphone.
Sorry. He still could be the promised.
Yeah, no, there's the fact that there is some talk. There is some talk that they will start him this season.
Oh, really?
Like that they could go to him this season.
That never happened, so for freshman quarterbacks.
Apparently he went 10 of 10 in September when he came in off the bench.
He's their Jake Haener.
He is their Jake Haener. So far,
he's going to come in. They're going to be up on Michigan, and he's going to come in.
Yeah, he's a redshirt freshman so far this season. 23 of 28 for 269 yards and a touchdown with 19 carries for 126 yards.
Man.
It'd be a really amazing game.
Wow. Wish we would have locked him in when he was 12.
Well,
we had him for several years, I think.
If Sark hadn't left,
he committed to UW?
Yeah.
I thought so.
As a 12-year-old?
Yeah, he accepted the scholarship. I mean, he committed to like 3 or 4 different schools, I think, at some point.
It's a pretty loose commitment.
It's a very soft one, yes. So,
my God.
To go back to Sam Heward, it's got to be a Husky.
Oh yeah, there's no way.
I didn't realize until the news stories this week that the Hewards, like they're, I think they're grandfather on their mom's side or something like that, but someone played it to, or maybe it's his grandfather on his mom's side. So there's like another generation at UW as well. Wow. So like he's got to go. Yeah.
I mean, so what's a quarterback situation at that point? That would be,
that's a very long time from now.
2 years? Is that how many years?
He would come in 2 years from, he's got two more years in high school. So he would come in 3 years from now.
Assuming Eason takes a job.
He's in class. Eason has nothing. He's class of 2021. It's a long time.
So he's competing with Sermon and.
But even then, they would be like a junior.
Yeah.
Right?
So he wouldn't have to, like.
Eh. It's a long ways out.
I mean, hopefully, we're not going to be starting any more freshmen. We're talking it might be until the year 2023 until we see Sam Heward play as a quarterback at UW.
If that.
Yeah, yes. Mark your calendars.
One of the ridiculous things about recruiting.
He has to go to UW, though. Like, I mean, come on.
I mean, not all kids.
He does not have to.
Follow their parents.
Luke Heward didn't go to UW.
There's one Heward who didn't go to UW. And where is he now? Did he play in the NFL? Is he a professional broadcaster? Has anybody heard from Luke Heward?
No.
I mean, not personally.
Wow.
It would be kind of weird.
Really makes you think.
You're looking this up now.
Oh, yeah.
Where is Luke Heward?
He is the co-offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach at Sac State.
That's pretty good.
So there you go.
Wow. That's, you know, it's nice, I guess, for a quarterback who didn't go to UW.
All right, let's talk about Oregon State and Jonathan Smith, who has improved their offense from 107th last year in terms of FPI efficiency to 59th so far this year. So check that out. That's a significant improvement. Unfortunately, Oregon State ranks 125th out of the 130 teams in defensive efficiency in FPI, and unfortunately for them. Fortunately for the Huskies.
Fortunately.
Yeah. Beavers rank 104th overall in FPI. That is the second lowest of any team from a Power 5 conference, just ahead of Rutgers, who was not on the Husky schedule this year, alas. Cupcake opponent.
So you can't talk about that, Mr. ESPN.
The Beavers won 134.
You were basically on the field with those cupcakes.
He made the cupcakes.
He showed up to the tailgate and was like, guys, I brought cupcakes. Nobody said anything when he brought a bunch of them to the game.
The Beavers.
He disappeared for a long time before the game started, and we didn't know why.
Had to deliver him to the sidelines. The Beavers won 41-34 in overtime at Colorado a few weeks ago for their first win over an FBS opponent since the end of the 2016 season. They also did beat an FCS opponent earlier this year. In terms of individual performance, injury-plagued Marysville native Jake Luton has played pretty well at quarterback when he's been healthy this year, completing 65% of his passes for 7.7 yards per attempt. He ranks 7th in the Pac-12 and QBR. Although he's pretty immobile, he ranks last among Pac-12 quarterbacks in rushing EPA. They've also gotten great play offensively from freshman running back Jamar Jefferson, who is averaging 120 yards per game on the ground on 6.0 yards per carry. They have a diverse receiving group with three receivers with at least 40 catches. The problem, again, defensively, they have just 9 sacks through 10 games as compared to 15 for UW, which we consider
not,
to be...
Yeah, this is not a great number for
no, UW. Not a great number. They rank last in the conference, forcing 0.8 turnovers per game, and are getting gashed for 6.9 yards per carry, which ranks 129th out of the 130 FBS teams, better than only UConn. They are also allowing a Pac-12 high 8.2 yards per pass attempt.
Let's get Shoddy as the offensive coordinator for this one.
So... if the Huskies don't score a lot of points, something has gone horribly wrong. Even speaking as a defender of the offense.
I think Oregon State, they're a little wily. That's why this line of 32 doesn't make me feel good. I think Oregon State will cover the spread. But
I also think that.
They're not particularly well suited to play against UW. You know, their offense is improved, but they're going against one of the better defenses that they'll face this year.
Yeah.
And UW should score points, a lot of points in this game.
And then especially with that poor run defense, you'd assume the Huskies can just chew up a lot of clock, long possessions, that sort of thing, which is, I think, what they would like to do. Maybe not as much as Shoddy, but still would like to do. working a lot of different running backs. There was the game where like three different Huskies ran for 100 yards against Oregon State a few years ago, the week before Thanksgiving. I don't know if you guys recall that one. One of them, I'm pretty sure, was Siler Miles at that point.
One of the running backs was Siler?
No, no, he was just one of the people who ran for 100-plus yards, yeah.
If Jake Browning runs for 100 yards... Face tattooed on my chest. No.
Don't do it.
That's a binding contract. We're about to get to that.
It's just a perfectly set up game for the Huskies.
Yeah.
Percentage chances of winning?
FPI says 98%. I figure I may as well just go with that.
Katie?
I don't know. 80? 85? Wow. I don't like to be too certain about anything.
The same. That's the same probability. 80% is you calling the Cal upset.
It was a nervous 80%. I'm going to go 95%. I mean, I would be shocked if the Huskies lost this game.
I was contemplating the take today, like, oh, if the Huskies lose this game, they should fire Coach Pete. Which, on the one hand, is a terrible way to make a decision like that. But on the other hand, it's, like, so improbable that who cares?
You're going to have fired Coach Pete by next week.
We wrap up with the Seahawks, who I guess concluded this brutal weekend for Seattle sports with a 36-31 loss to the LA Rams, which actually was like a really impressive performance, all things considered, on the road against the previously 7-1 Rams. And now, short turnaround this week, coming off a 2-game losing streak as they try to snap that, on Thursday Night Football against the Green Bay Packers. And what is really a crucial game for the Seahawks' playoff chances, Green Bay comes into this one a half game ahead of the Seahawks in the standings at 4-4-1, making this an important swing game and whether the Seahawks can secure one of the two wild card spots now that the NFC West is even more off limits to them. It is a possibility, as was mentioned on the broadcast on Sunday, if the Seahawks lose this week, the Rams could clinch the NFC West by beating the Chiefs on Monday night. So,
I mean, that's not something we're really...
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But definitely the Seahawks should try not losing to the Packers. That would be better.
True, yes. Yes. I'd like that.
All right, one of the big takeaways from the game against the Rams was the breakout performance, the improbable breakout performance with Chris Carson sidelined in this one, as he was in the second half of the previous week's game against the LA Chargers, of rookie Rashad Penny, who had been buried on the bench for most of the season, not even get seen the field. But in this one, got loose after coming into the game in reserve behind Mike Davis, ended up with 12 carries for a career-high 108 yards and a touchdown. Thoughts?
It was exciting.
It was. You have to assume what the Seahawks thought they were getting when they drafted Rashad Penny.
Yeah.
I mean, not that they necessarily expected him to average 9 yards per carry, but the kind of explosiveness and decisive running that we saw from him is what they presumably saw all along.
Yeah, it was great. It was great to see Rashad Penny. I mean, honestly, any of the running backs probably could have done this
right
against the Rams D-line. And, like, Mike Davis looked good in this game also.
Yes.
They ran the ball well. Chris Carson would have also run the ball well. Rashad Penny happened to be the one this week.
It's almost like running backs don't matter.
The excitement that Pete Carroll and Shoddy must have had while this was happening, though, the play where Russell is out there, like, lead blocking for Rashad Penny, that had to be the best moment of the year for both of them.
And for John Schneider.
All three. They all high-fived after the game. They're like, we'll take the loss if we didn't look quite as horrible for this draft pick.
Despite the fact that the Seahawks trailed... Well, I guess not much of the fourth quarter. They did lead at one point in the fourth quarter, right? Despite the fact that they almost exclusively, well, large, I can't even say almost exclusively threw at the end of this game. The last drive, though, there was a lot of passes. 34 runs in this game to 26 passes. A few scrambles in there for Russell Wilson, who had 9 carries for a season-high 92 yards on the ground.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, that was nice to see.
Like, I think they decided, like, we need to win this game. This is an important game. So we're gonna let Russell run.
I assume that it also I don't know how much of that is dictated by the coaching staff as much as it's his own health.
And so he's finally feeling like he can do this now.
Yeah.
So welcome to see. so excited because I feel like it makes the defense really has to think about things in different ways than.
He kept on, had a rare keep on a read option at one point in this game, which certainly helps open that up for the running backs.
The most important running back on this team is Russell Wilson.
Okay. Just like Siler Miles.
Russell Wilson running is huge. It was like we got unleashed Russell Wilson here. And then we saw a little bit of it at the end of the Chargers game. Honestly, I would like to see it happen maybe a little bit earlier in the game.
Yes. I mean, clearly he's not going to take a lot of risks. Like, you can definitely tell the risk calculation that he does by the fact that when the Seahawks are trailing in the fourth quarter, that's when he starts running a bunch.
Really, he takes more risks standing in the pocket. Well, I mean,
it's true. Donald I agree with that. Especially if it's putting them in third down situations. And that was the story in this game. The Seahawks, of course, run an unusually high amount on first and second down and pick up an unusually small number of first downs with those runs on first and second down, putting themselves in third down spots. They didn't actually have a ton of third downs in this game because they did run the ball so well. But of their 9 third downs, Russell Wilson was sacked 4 times on those. More times than the Seahawks converted first downs out of those third downs, which was 3 of 9.
How many times did they run play action on those third downs? Do we have that stat?
I doubt they did at all.
Many, considering why you could still run play action on third down.
I do think it is less effective on third down.
It doesn't matter. Try it. He's being sacked instantly on these plays. Even if it holds up the defense for a second, it's just still being held. I feel like I'm saying the same thing every single week about the offense. But
are there statistics that actually measure this? Like,
you got to talk into the microphone.
are there statistics that actually measure the effectiveness of play action on third down for the Seahawks or, you know, for any team?
They would have to do a Ben B study. But yes.
Okay.
Your sample size
is there. But we know that they're effective on play action and every other down. So what's the difference?
That run is no longer a credible threat on third and eight. And also you're often running, you're often out of the shotgun.
There's something psychological for a defender to see the running back look like they're going to get a handoff. Also, can we just get a little bit more pre-snap motion? We should be watching what the Rams are doing and being like that.
I agree.
Every single play there is a receiver coming through.
I mean, if that's what you're asking for, you're going to be disappointed.
You get one Tyler Lockett end around per game and you'll like it.
A source of much consternation on Seahawks Twitter has been the use of empty formations on third and...
Did they do that often?
They did it a few times.
Well, that was the other thing I was thinking about Russell running.
I haven't seen stats on it, though.
To be able to have Russell run, or at least scramble, you have to call a passing play.
That is undoubtedly true.
So he's not going to be able to do it that much when he's only passing the ball 13 times before the fourth quarter.
Yeah. I mean, he's not run it very much in times when he has been throwing a lot more passes before the fourth quarter. So I don't think that's that big of a factor in that. But
what if they just switched it up one game?
Yeah, they're not going to do that. Again, like, you can hope that all you want. It's not going to change. I'd like to see some stats on the empty sets because I remember a few years ago, Shil Kapadia, when he was at ESPN covering the Seahawks, wrote that it was like their most effective was... They were at their most effective out of those empty sets. And it really didn't square with how nervous I get every time the Seahawks go empty. But the numbers don't lie. So certainly trouble blocking Aaron Donald in this one on third down, who had 2.5 of those 4 sacks. Yeah, we discussed the predictability of play calling. Oh, you wanted to talk about the record in one score games for the Seahawks, who dropped to 1-5.
So there was a tweet from Aaron Schatz earlier this week where he tweeted the Seahawks are 1-5 in games decided by 8 points or less, 1-4 in games decided by 7 points or less, basically adding in that Chargers game last week.
Yes.
And to me, this is like, we see the stat and we're like, oh, the Seahawks have been unlucky. Which I'm sure to some extent the team has been slightly unlucky because their point differential is still probably better than a 4-5 team typically would be. Is that right? What is the point differential?
They are plus 27 on the season. So yes, that checks out.
So, I mean, to some extent they are unlucky. But when you look at these games, it's basically this tweet is treating every single one score game as if it's the same. And when you look back at these games, where they got the ball in the fourth quarter in these one-score games, the last 2 weeks, we know for a fact that they were in desperation situations.
Yes.
Like, they managed to score the touchdown first and then get the ball back, which, by the way, kudos to Pete Carroll for having all three timeouts both weeks in a row.
Yep.
Like, Pete Carroll somehow got a little bit smarter at coaching in the last couple of weeks, at least with regards to timeouts.
I mean, there weren't any situations that they, like, took a delay of game instead of it. I mean, I think some of it is just kind of your execution.
They had to have talked to Russell.
Wasn't there one point in the game when there was a delay of game and it was after, or was it a false start?
It was after a kickoff, yes.
Oh, yes. God. See, that could have been a play.
Could have been a play that they could have blown a timeout, though.
I think that was in the first half, though, wasn't it?
Even still.
I don't think that was in the first half.
Why? I'm not saying that. I'm just saying in terms of whether the decision making on whether to use a timeout in that situation or not.
It's
better than blowing a timeout. In that situation.
Yeah. I agree.
Keeping those timeouts meant that they were able to have these drives at the end of the game that they had the last 2 weeks, which they still fucking lost both the games. But going into these last drives, because the Seahawks have gotten the ball every single one of these games that they are down one score, right?
They have gotten the ball down one score at some point in the fourth quarter in all of them, yes.
So looking at their percentage chances of victory, you pulled this up, in these losses, these five losses that they had.
Yes.
And this is their percentage. This is their percentage chances of victory at the start of that drive.
Yes.
6.5% against the Broncos. Basically no chance.
Yeah.
19% against the Bears. But did Russ throw a pick in that game?
So that was before the pick six, I believe. Yes, it's the 19%. Never got the ball back again, down one score.
41.5% against the Rams. And that's before they turned the ball over and the Rams had the fourth down conversion.
Did they turn it over or they punt it?
Or whatever. I mean, a punt is a turnover.
Fair point. Yes, this is when they had, in that case, they were down two, so a field goal would have given them the lead. That's why, and then there was also a lot more time on the clock, which is why that number is so much higher.
I mean, honestly, that was the game that they had the best chance of actually winning,
yes,
of any of these games.
Yes.
7% against the Chargers. We're talking about them going the entire field, needing to score a touchdown plus a two-point conversion just to get to overtime in that game.
And that was 7% after a roughing the passer on their first play of the drive. I couldn't find before the first play of the drive.
Let's just assume it was worse.
Yes.
And then 9.8% when they get the ball back against the Rams with a minute 30 this week.
Yes.
So none of these situations were situations where you'd look at it and say, like, the team got unlucky. They were lucky to have gotten the ball in any of these situations. And for the last 2 weeks, at the very least, they were lucky to have even been in the situation to be down by one score.
I mean,
it took like fourth down conversions and long, impressive drives before that.
But weren't there like close games in the Super Bowl era Seahawks?
I just feel like they were different.
Like, I think they were different.
Because of
Jermaine Kearse.
There we go.
Oh, wow.
But I'm half joking, but I'm half serious in that, like, there was like a magic that could occur between Russell and someone else, and he would scramble and find someone, and we'd come back and win these games, close games.
That's still sort of happening, though. It's just that they're down by two scores when that happens now.
Mm. Okay. Right.
Like, I remember there being games in the, like, peak era, the peak Pete and Russell era, where it would always be the other team coming down the field and trying to score on the Seahawks defense. And sometimes it happened, but most of the time it didn't.
Most notably, of course, the NFC Championship game. The Niners won.
Yeah. But there's tons in there where teams, I mean, the Patriots.
That's why I said most notably.
The Patriots on that Sunday night game where they came down and didn't score. There were so many times where it was the other team trying to have the game-winning drive and the Seahawks protecting a lead. These are desperation attempts at the end of games that they happen to make into one-score games. Honestly, it's a fucking coincidence that they were one-score games.
I mean, on average, you would probably expect the Seahawks to have won one of these games based on the combined win probabilities. But again, none of those games were they more likely to not to win at the start of the drive.
I mean, if they had won one of these games, it'd make a huge swing playoff-wise, though.
Yes.
So can we talk about two things that happened in this game?
Yes.
The first is the onside kick.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and then the second is the spiking of the ball.
Mm.
So I'm curious to hear people's opinions on both of those things.
I'm going to flip the table over about spikes. This team is overly spike aggressive. I hate spiking the ball.
I don't have a strong take on it. I would want to see what the numbers look like. I mean, there's certainly value in slowing down and having some time to actually call a play from the sideline instead of constantly being in hurry up mode. And there's also a question of, you know, given where everyone is on the field, how long is it going to take to get set and actually call a play? Those are the two kind of factors in consideration.
They should
and
have
I think
a
it's
play
easy to
before
say,
then. If they're running ahead, they should every single player on the field should know what the play is going to be.
I don't think that's realistic because you don't know what the situation is going to be. The reason you're spiking the ball is because you've gained yards and you're in a different situation.
But shouldn't you have a play for, say, you're at, above the 30?
I mean, they have certain play calls. That's what Russell Wilson is signaling with hand signals. But again, making that decision, getting that called, that all takes time. And it's easy
downs
to see.
Downs matter. Downs matter a lot in these situations.
But so does time. And if the Husky, you know.
What is the time difference? Seconds? 2 seconds between running a play and spiking the ball?
I mean, I don't know it. That's why I want to see the math on it. But what I would say is it's easy to see the result when it doesn't happen. You don't know what the alternative is because you can just imagine that things worked out then because you don't have to actually see it play out.
I was furious about spikes in that Chargers game when things still worked out for them, all things considered. Like, they achieved...
If you consider, I mean, getting one play with no time on the clock working
out. They
got
the ball to the 1 yard line.
I mean, they did. It took a lot happening.
Despite the fact that they were spiking the ball, they should never spike the ball.
Have the Seahawks gotten false starts on spiking situations? Or is that just something I made up?
I'm sure at some point they have. I don't remember it specifically.
I mean, that's the risk is the 10-second runoff. But you still have the risk when you're spiking the ball is that people don't line up right.
But it's minimized because of the fact that you just have to stand there as opposed to like figuring out what you're doing.
An extra down in the situation this week would have been huge.
I just think you should regress this opinion to the mean, given the lack of data about it.
Never will I regress this opinion to the mean. I am very anti-spike.
I also don't have a take on the onside kick. I do have a take, which is don't cite the number of failed consecutive Sebastian Janikowski onside kicks as evidence that they shouldn't onside kick, because most of those
cite
undoubtedly...
Cite the fact that he's due. Oh,
this is a subtweet of my husband.
Most of these, yes, it is. Most of these, those undoubtedly are situations where they are expected onside kicks, and expected and unexpected onside kicks are very different.
It was like now, 65 to 20 or something like that. Percent.
In terms of the, I think it's even lower than that on expected. I think it's like 5 to 10 at this point. Now, the one thing is we probably don't have enough data to really know what the percentage chances are. Yeah, because as Ben B tweeted about. The rules changes on kickoffs this year mean that there are more players in the box and potentially players.
They actually talked about it on the broadcast.
Yeah, they did mention it.
Potential players with good
hands. For these rules changes?
That they want to have fewer collisions when players are at top speed far down the field.
If
also,
they got
get
rid
of the
kickoffs. What would
would you do an onside kick?
You would just every field onside kick.
Well, you would just have to only be able to line up 2 onside kick.
Announce to the other team, we are onside kicking.
Well, I mean, that's what you would do at the end of games. You couldn't do a surprise onside kick. I was surprised. You know what I was actually more disappointed about? That Michael Dixon, they weren't able to better execute that last kick when Dixon came on, because it seems like there's a great opportunity to kind of kick the ball to about like the 35 or the 40, where it's in between where the hands team is up and the one returner, and then you race down and try to recover it. Like, Dixon seems uniquely capable of executing that, but they didn't really, I don't think, try to do that. Maybe that was the plan. I don't know.
If it was the plan, Michael Dixon would have executed it.
He's not a robot.
He's perfect. By the way, another great Dixon game.
Yes, it was.
The thing that I like about the onside kick is you either get it, low possibility, but also... you're shortening the field for the Rams to score.
They're taking less time off the clock.
I mean, honestly, like, it probably helped them in the end. I argued this to you about Russell Wilson and the pick six in the San Diego game. And the thing that got them into the possibility of being able to tie San Diego, I mean, also LA.
Yeah. They only played one. Seattle sports teams only played one San Diego team this week, and that was the Toreros.
In the Chargers game, the fact that the interception was returned for a touchdown is what allowed the Seahawks to have that drive at the end of the game.
I suppose on some level it did.
If the Chargers
also you could have just not thrown an interception.
But I'm saying if he had to throw an interception, returning it for a touchdown was worse for the Chargers than just going down immediately and letting them take a minute, whatever, 2 minutes off the clock.
Don't tell Ha Ha Clinton Dix. You don't recall this play?
This is the play where he tried to return it or whatever.
No, he didn't try to return it.
Oh, he went straight down.
He should have tried to return it in hindsight.
But again, this is the type of thing where it's like the fact that they got that kick and it was a relatively fast drive after that meant that the Seahawks had time at the end of the game.
I mean, that to me minimizes the downside because of the fact that the Rams were moving the ball up and down the field so effortlessly, the St. Louis Rams. there's
the
not...
greatest show on turf.
That 10 a.m. start was rough. Because of that, there's not as much a risk like, oh no, we gave up 30 yards of field position. The Rams make that up in 3 plays.
Yes.
So
the Rams are too good.
Yeah. But you know who's not too good?
Seahawks. It's
only okay. The Green Bay Packers. And let's talk about this week's game. A notable storyline, I think the number of players the Packers have who did not travel to Seattle with the team on Tuesday night is first reported by ESPN's Rob Domofsky. Wide receiver Randall Cobb with a hamstring injury, linebacker Nick Perry with a knee injury. Pour some out for quarterback Kevin King with a hamstring injury who will not be making his return to Seattle this weekend, it appears.
This is a good thing.
And safety Kentrell Bryce with an ankle injury. The Packers also have had their starting tackles, David Bakhtiari and Brian Bulaga, limited in practice, both with knee injuries. Inside linebacker Blake Martinez with an ankle injury and quarterback Bashaud Breeland with a groin injury. All four of them did play last Sunday. I think Breeland left that game. Perhaps the most interesting and notable injury of these is Kentrell Bryce at safety, who was replaced by undrafted rookie Raven Green. Played reasonably well, but I think someone the Seahawks will probably look to pick
Raven
on a little bit.
Green.
Yes.
So Man. Raven.
So Raven.
That's so Raven. It really sounds like a color.
It does. You'd find Raven that in Green. Your Crayola box. All right, the Packers.
They replaced Haha Clinton Dix with Raven Green.
They sure did.
Clinton Dix has a better name.
The Packers offense comes into this week ranked number 8, number 13 in passing offense, and number 2 in rush DVOA, according to Football Outsiders DVOA. This has suddenly become a run-first team in some ways, led by second-year running back Aaron Jones, who is number 1 in DVOA among running backs with at least 50 carries, averaging 6.8 yards per carry, including a season-high 15 carries for a career-high 145 yards on Sunday in their win over the Miami Dolphins. Jones averaged 5.5 yards per carry in limited action as a rookie, so there was some indication that he could be this effective, but he has been really unstoppable, and that will be a test for the Seahawks run defense that has been struggling a little bit lately. Aaron Rodgers, just 19th in QBR, 2 spots behind Russell Wilson. Kind of surprisingly, even with his knee injury, he's still 5th in rushing expected points added, a category in which Russell ranks 14th, having moved from negative to positive entirely with last week's performance. So I was kind of curious why Rodgers ranks better by DVOA than QBR. Usually you see this with quarterbacks like Jared Goff is the most notable example, who throw a lot of shorter passes, have a lot of yards after catch. The Packers aren't really notable in that regard, as far as I could tell. So I think maybe part of it is the way he's getting credit for their success on third down. If you split Rodgers' stats by down this year, on first down, he's averaging 7.3 yards per attempt. Second down, 6.9 yards per attempt. But on third down, 10.1 yards per attempt this season. Hasn't necessarily translated into a ton of first downs.
Third and 15.
It hasn't necessarily translated
so frustrating
into a ton of first downs, but they've had big plays in those situations. Cobb, who will likely miss this game. Packers
he didn't
probably,
travel with the team. He's missing this game.
I mean, there's a chance that he could fly out separately after, but he has been, they probably won't miss him. He's been pretty ineffective this year, averaging just 10 yards per reception. He's been replaced in the lineup by 5th-round pick Marquez Valdes-Scantling, who has been a big play threat with 17.5 yards per reception, including 2 catches of 50-plus yards. He's among the top 10 in the NFL in yards after catch per reception. Devontae Adams, of course, remains the go-to option for the Packers with a team-high 94 targets, more than one quarter of Rodgers' total pass attempts this season. Our old friend Jimmy Graham has only rated around replacement level for the second consecutive season. His catch rate is again around 59% after it was 65% previously in his NFL career, including 68% in 2016. His yards per catch has bounced back to 13.3 yards per catch, slightly better than his career average from last year's career low 9.1, but that's partially because he's not being targeted very much in the red zone. He has 2 touchdowns, and according to Pro Football Reference, has been targeted just 4 times inside the 10-yard line this season, with 1 catch for a touchdown. Fire Daryl Bevel.
Just wait till they start targeting him 4 years from now.
Yeah.
It's going to be a monster in the red zone.
They are really good at class problems then.
It is kind of interesting how little you think about Jimmy Graham on the Seahawks offense.
Yes. Just kind of moved on.
Yep. I mean, there's a lot of players that the Seahawks lost that we've kind of moved on from. Not Michael Bennett or Sheldon Richardson, of course.
No.
But offensively, I feel like a lot of the players that were lost over there. I mean, you look at Paul Richardson, it's just like, who?
Tyler Lockett's going to be great now. David Moore is going to be amazing other than the Chargers game.
The scariest player on this Green Bay offense is Aaron Jones.
That's, you know, the Rodgers thing. Third Pelton brother Ben B has been leading the charge against Aaron Rodgers online.
He's been out of the league in two years.
He's against Aaron Rodgers now?
This is what happens.
He is against Aaron Rodgers now?
When Ben B is against you, all things just start turning.
I saw what happened to Derek Carr.
Yeah. It's,
God.
they clearly are reading the tweets.
A small contingent of critics of Derek Carr. I don't think that was actually relating to Seahawks Twitter. I assume that was about NFL executives that Mike Sando was talking to. Yeah, I mean, look, I wanted to blame this on Rodgers' injury, but the fact is he actually, when you look at the advanced stats, is not as effective as I thought he was, because he seemed really effective for a long period of time, and he makes terrifying throws, and he always beats the Seahawks in Green Bay in horrifying fashion.
That's in Green Bay.
That is in Green Bay.
When was the last time you beat the Seahawks? In Seattle.
I don't know that he's ever done it.
Well, with decisive victories in Seattle.
He would argue that it was during Russell Wilson's rookie season.
But Aaron Jones is terrifying, especially given what the Seahawks have done against the run the last 2 weeks, where if they're not able to, and granted, the quarterbacks that they have open things up, and Aaron Rodgers will do the same for Aaron Jones. But I think this is one where the Seahawks need to shut down Aaron Jones. If they can have this be one of the types of games where we've seen in the past where a team has a good running back that the Seahawks are able to shut down and we want them to run the ball, that is going to be a win for the Seahawks.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see. Tony Romo did a good job on the broadcast last week of pointing out the number of times that the Seahawks went to, he was calling it the Buddy Ryan front.
Yeah, basically the 46 defense.
I mean, it's not the full 46 defense because I don't think they necessarily had the line, because that was like a 4-4 defense, basically four down linemen and 4 linebackers effectively, but the front is similar in terms of just, you know, overloading the gaps to overloading the middle to make sure that you're not going to be able to run up the middle. And it'll be interesting to see if they try that against Jones and try to force the Packers to pass, which is a weird statement to say.
It's gonna be a very fascinating thing to watch.
But they were also doing that against the Rams, who have a better passing attack over the course of the season.
It makes more sense against the Packers than it does against the Rams. I'm more scared of Jared Goff and the Rams passing attack than I am of the Packers.
Okay. Should we talk about the Packers defense, which comes in ranked 14th? And notably, the split there, 9th against the pass and 26th against the run, allowing 4.6 yards per carry to opposing running backs.
Paging Brian Schottenheimer.
Chris Carson, it sounds like, is going to be back. DJ Fluker, it sounds like, is going to be back. This could be a big running game for the Seahawks. Not that the last few haven't been, but this could be another one.
We're going to run every freaking play.
But it could allow them to run a good offense, as you have talked about at length. The pass defense for the Packers is more interesting to talk about, I think. They are number 9 overall, but that's kind of a split between they are number 1 in the NFL in adjusted sack rate, despite getting just 2.5 sacks from Clay Matthews and 1.5 sacks from Nick Perry, who will likely miss this game. They are really doing it by committee. 6 players have at least 2 sacks, 15 different players have recorded at least a half sack for the Packers, as compared to 8 for the Seahawks over the course of the season. They are led by nose tackle Kenny Clark, who has 5, and then also rush specialist, and stop me if you've ever heard of this player before in his third year with the Packers, Kyler Fackrell, who also has 5. He played more last week with Perry leaving the game with injury, and probably will play a lot more this week. And this will be a test of the Seahawks offensive line. But
if the Seahawks ever pass the ball.
That is true. But if they can protect Russell Wilson, the Packers are 20th in terms of yards per attempt allowed this season and 26th in DVOA against deep passes. They've allowed 6 passes of 40-plus yards this season, as compared to 2 allowed by the Seahawks all season. Green Bay also 20th in terms of forcing turnovers. So you would have to say that this is kind of, especially then with a starting safety missing this game, an undrafted rookie starting in his place in all likelihood, this game is like really well set up for the Seahawks to run the ball effectively and take deep shots on play action.
Yeah, exactly.
It's set up well for the Seahawks offense. They're going to run like full-on army offense in this game, though. Like,
they're going to run a triple option.
The amount of times that we see Russell Wilson pass the ball is going to be minimal.
Green Bay comes into this game struggling on special teams. They've had really poor returns on both punts and kicks. They will get their kick returner, Trevor Davis, back in this game in all likelihood after he's missed the entire season so far with a hamstring injury. Mason Crosby, their usually reliable kicker, has missed a pair of extra points.
Both of the same game.
Yeah, that Detroit game.
He had one nightmare game.
Yeah.
And it's been pretty effective otherwise. I think this one is set up pretty nicely for the Seahawks. I mean, having a team, and honestly, I mean, the Rams this last weekend were similar, and the offense was pretty good.
Yes.
I mean, when you're talking about I guess that was a five-point loss on the road against one of the best teams in the NFL. Now you're bringing that home, and if you can score the kind of points that they were able to score in that game against this Green Bay team, I think they're looking at a win.
We were talking during the game about the line for this one. We were doing our own guess the lines, and we had the Seahawks -4, I think, right?
4. I thought it would be 4.5.
Implying that they're somewhat better on a neutral site. Instead, because it's typically about a 3.5 point swing for home field, instead it's Seahawks -2.5 right now, which implies that Vegas thinks that Green Bay is the better team on a neutral field, which is not supported by advanced stats.
It's also their Green Bay.
They are a public team.
Yes.
That's true.
And people bet on them. So I was surprised to see that. I mean, the advanced stats for the Seahawks over the last 5 weeks have been pretty good. You know, I think that was another thing that Aaron Schatz tweeted about, that in weeks 1 and 2, they ranked like 21st in DVOA. And since then, they've ranked like 12th in DVOA.
Yeah, and their losses in that span have come twice to the second-ranked team in DVOA, those being the Rams. And
by a total of 7 points.
Once to the third-ranked team, the Chargers.
I don't know, could this be a game, though, where like they are able to run all over us?
That would be the concern.
Okay. And then we do a thing where we run fairly well, and then we take shots downfield, and for whatever reason, we miss them.
I mean, those are high variance plays.
And it just doesn't work out for us.
It's certainly possible.
Like, I could see that happening and how things have gone. And
yep.
And then the Seahawks get the ball down 8 with a minute and a half left.
And we think there's a chance. We really do.
Well, against Green Bay, we have seen that 7% chance come up. We've seen it before.
I think
where have you gone, Golden Tate, though, to the Philadelphia bench, apparently?
They'll score touchdowns in this game against this Green Bay defense. Their rushing attack will work. The play action will work. They will score in this game. It's going to be Thursday night. People are going to be amped up in Seattle. It's like, and it's a must-win game for the Seahawks. The playoffs are out of question if they lose this game.
Out of question?
If they go to 4-6, they basically need to win out.
They're very unlikely, but
if they go to 4-6, they will need to win out with games against Minnesota, at Carolina, and against the Chiefs.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
Oh god! Percentage chances of victory, Katie.
I'm completely uneducated to do this. I would say 45%.
Wow, less than 50% chance.
Yeah.
Katie, the famous cousin Katie, noted for her pessimism.
I think there's a 65% chance of winning this game.
In classic Peltoncast fashion, I am going to say precisely 5% less. I think the Seahawks have a 60% chance of winning this one.
It just feels like the Green Bay defense, it's been a weird season, and like the things that the Seahawks want to do, they've sort of been able to do and score enough points, and they just need to limit Green Bay a little bit. But if they can get to 28, 30 points in this game against Green Bay, they'll probably win.
Yeah, and they're well built to play from ahead, particularly in this matchup. Yes. So I mean, they can get
early. Like, even talked about that, where he was like, these things work when you're ahead. The pass rush works when you're ahead. All these things work when you're ahead. And it's like, just try getting ahead then.
I highly recommend it. All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.